Artificial intelligence has crept up on us, but suddenly it's everywhere. Your laptop, mobile, the dashboard of your car, the ads you watch, the music you hear, they're all AI-driven. It's reframing our lives. Some of last year's jump in productivity, the biggest for 7 years, may be down to the impact of AI. But what about the public sphere, government and the public realm? We know that 70% of government departments are piloting or planning AI projects. What are the risks of using AI in the public sector? When algorithms start influencing decisions about benefits, policing, healthcare, or immigration, the stakes become incredibly high. Poor quality data can embed bias and over-reliance on technology, can both erode human judgment and accountability. In Britain, the legacy of the Horizon IT scandal, where faulty software led to wrongful prosecutions of sub-postmasters, has already deepened public distrust of automated systems making life-changing decisions. If AI is to be successfully rolled out across all public services, transparency, oversight, and meaningful human involvement will be essential. Without that and the trust it could bring, the public may simply withdraw their support. So how to navigate these tricky waters? We don't want to create a monstrous big brother, but equally, we want AI to make government better and more responsive. So to help us is Imogen Parker. She's Associate Director in Social and Economic Policy at the Ada Lovelace Institute at the Nuffield Foundation, on a mission to improve social well-being through research and innovation. In her role, she leads research and policy work on how AI is used, should be used, in public services and by governments, with a particular focus on understanding and shaping public attitudes, trust, governance, and societal impact. With the tagline, "Learn fast and write things," the Ada Lovelace Institute moves at lightning speed. And Imogen is here, lightning speed, to tell us their latest findings. Now, Imogen, I mean, a lot to get through. How big a deal is AI potentially for the public sector?
I think it could be a really big deal for the public sector. And we've seen questions of data-driven technologies and algorithms move from not a fringe concern, but something that is now so central to the political agenda. And I think we saw that around this time last year when Keir Starmer gave a speech at the launch of the AI Opportunities Plan. And he said, you know, this is the defining issue of our generation. He said that AI was throwing down a gauntlet to the public sector, that there was a real opportunity to completely rewire the state, and it was something that we kind of had to seize and we shouldn't be fearful of. So I think given the rapid evolution of data-driven tools and AI, in particular in the last few years, given the creation of things like generative AI tools like ChatGPT or these general purpose tools that we see people using formally in public sector, but also just informally in their own lives, I think these technologies are absolutely here to stay. They're moving very quickly. And so the question is then, how do we make sure we get this right? How do we use them in a way that creates the sort of state, the sort of public services we all want? How do we make these enable a state that's more responsive or more relational or puts people at the heart of it, a state that feels legitimate and trustworthy? And how do we make sure we do all of that as the technologies are moving and evolving at our feet?
Now, there's a big phrase in there about re-engineering the state.
Yeah, I think it's rewiring the state, I think, is what he said. Yeah, it felt like a kind of really big moment for a prime minister to be talking about how central this was to this political project, to the government. This isn't a kind of IT issue off the side. This is very much how does the state behave and respond and interact with its citizens.
You know, give listeners an example or two about what that actually means, you know, from where we are to where we could be.
I guess where we are is suddenly we've got the ability to have so much more data and information about citizens, about public services, about how they're working in real time. I guess we've got the potential to link up information across different bits of the often siloed public sector. We've got opportunity for, I guess, if we're thinking very blue skies, we've got opportunities for people to be seen and understood in the round. So I'm sure everyone has had wildly frustrating interactions with the state where they have multiple different localized questions or different logons or bits and pieces that feel contradictory and they're trying to make sense of something or navigate a problem. I guess if we get data better set up, you could think this could be much more responsive. It could be predictive. It could go to the time. It could allocate resource to the cases that really need it. It could try and get in early before problems escalate. You've got all these kind of positive narratives about perhaps what more data and kind of more artificial intelligence could do.
Point taken. There's an opportunity here because my engagement with the bits of the state I engage with, you know, the health service, HMRC, are quite good actually. So, you know, the state has an opportunity, surely, if it gets this right, to kind of get one over the private sector and be, you know, that's an exemplar of how it can be done.
Yeah, I mean, I think the state's got a real opportunity. There was a really good paper that came out, I think, last year. It's called A Blueprint for Modern Government. And I think what was really great about it was a very realistic assessment of where we are. And one of the real challenges in this space, particularly as soon as you use the word AI, there is just so much hype out there. And I thought what was really great in this paper was, you know, it was a very honest assessment of actually how the state is doing when it comes to digital services and where it could do better, and just a real focus on some of the boring basics, not getting seduced by the shiniest end of AI, just thinking, how do we make sure that we have the right templates to respond to people when they want to do things like renew a driving license or connect up the right bits of information? And I think where the state is proceeding really well, it's where it's thinking about those priorities that might not be the cutting edge or the most kind of exciting end of technological opportunity, really where they're responding to what citizens need, having services that are responsive and that are, I think, saving people time. So yeah, I think there's a real opportunity for the state if they get this right, but it's also, there's a lot to kind of navigate in ensuring that this stuff is done well.
Give us a sense of what you do from kind of day to day, a typical working week. What's the kind that crosses your desk and what's the kind of mind-boggling task you set yourself?
Ada's mission to ensure that data and AI work for people in society definitely keeps us busy and is a kind of rapidly evolving area that we work on. Right since our kind of creation, one of the biggest questions that we've been looking at is the role of the state and AI. So how should the state evolve in light of AI? How should public sector, how should public services use data? How are they using actually data-driven systems? And do we know what impact they're having across different groups in society? Do we know how they're working when they're really applied on the ground in services? And then also, what can we learn about the conditions that make sure that where you've got data-driven technologies, where you've got artificial intelligence being used, it works in a way that kind of does what it says on the tin. It really delivers its value for money. It's fair and it's seen as legitimate. So in terms of what kind of comes across my desk, a lot of the debate around AI can end up almost being very high level, very hype focused, very, you know, AI will revolutionize the state, or, you know, is kind of this thing that must be seized. What we do at Ada is really try to bring that down to the ground. So we do a lot of research that's very much focused on a specific use case or specific applications. So for example, at the moment, two of my colleagues, Lara Groves and Oliver Brough, have just published a brilliant piece of research looking at how social workers are currently using transcription tools in social care. How's it actually working when you take a specific piece of technology and you integrate it into a service? What does that look like? How does that feel? What do social workers want out of it? How are different people in the local authority thinking about it? How are they evaluating it? How do we get a bit more kind of systems thinking around the application? So, you know, we've looked at different sorts of use cases from biometric technologies, so that's things like facial recognition by policing. We've done an ethnographic study looking at the use of predictive analytics within a local authority. You know, how actually does that get rolled out? How does it get used? How do people talk about it amongst themselves? How do they look at ethics or accountability things? How does it get procured? Those sorts of questions. We've looked at some really cutting edge emerging technologies, so genomics in healthcare, or what was emerging a few years ago. We did a lot of work around things like COVID technologies and actually what are you building technically? How are they being applied? What sort of kind of legislative framework or governance do you need around those technologies? What do the public think about those technologies? We do a lot of research with publics to understand what their comfort levels are, what questions they have, what their priorities are, and really kind of where they sit in terms of how they want specific pieces of AI or data-driven tools being used in specific services.
Are the public really across this? I mean, when you ask them questions, how do they react? I mean, what do they say to you?
Well, I think we've just seen an absolutely huge increase of public discussion and debate and understanding about these topics from where we were even a few years ago. I think the development of generative AI tools, so things like the kind of ChatGPT type things that a lot of people have played with a bit or explored, it's suddenly very much something that can be in people's pockets. I also think we've had a lot of very big moments of kind of national debate from things like the Horizon scandal, Cambridge Analytica. I mean, right now, the questions around social media, for example, and young people, the public are very well versed in thinking about questions of algorithms, or they're talking about platforms, or they're talking about incentives for oversharing. You know, I think public understanding has come a really long way. But as well as doing more like traditional quant type studies, we also do a lot of really in-depth, deliberative type exercises like citizens' juries. So, for example, when it came to biometrics, we spent almost 6 months with two groups of 50 people across the UK, across lots of weekends where they had opportunities to take evidence from, you know, the biometrics commissioner, from Met Police, from Big Brother Watch, from different sorts of actors, really got to get deeper expertise in things like facial recognition. And then we asked them, okay, now you have this kind of much stronger understanding of the technology. How would you want it used? How would you want it regulated? What would make you feel confident in something this powerful being used in different bits of the public sector?
Because there is this kind of Big Brother fear, isn't there? That my mobile privacy dials, you know, I want my privacy. I certainly want it from the state. I imagine most people feel like I do. On the other hand, if I'm told knowledge about your movements, your data, hours you sleep, or whatever it might be, will help the generality, will promote the common good, I'm up for it.
Mm. Yeah, and we've looked across all the research that we've done with publics across the last, you know, 3, 4, 5 years, where it speaks to questions of public sector use. And some of those reflections are very much in public attitudes as well. So I think it's clear that the public do endorse the use of technology where they feel there really is a public interest, where they can see what that public interest is. Their comfort levels come with conditions and provisos.
Yep.
Yeah. So they
can you give us an example of that in practice?
The kind of conditions and provisos. Sure. So let's go back to the example of biometrics, because we did a lot of work there with different publics. So
this is just fingerprints and things like that.
So biometric technologies are technologies that are using data from the body to assess somebody, to kind of make predictions about somebody. So lots of people might have used it where it's just a thumbprint to unlock your phone, for example. That's a bit of biometric kind of technology that you're using there. But probably some of the most high profile use cases are things like live facial recognition by the police. So if you're walking around having scanners that can go look at somebody's face, take almost a kind of pattern of what their face looks like, and run that against a watch list and say, is that face pattern there? Is that anybody that we're looking for? Is that anybody that we need to pull over?
Is that Imogen Parker or is that Will Hutton looking a bit dodgy?
Exactly. So that's one example that I think has been in the news a lot, because we're seeing a kind of increase of use of that, both by the police, but even in things like supermarkets. And there were some examples of biometric technologies being used, for example, in schools as well. But it doesn't just need to be face recognition. It also includes things like gait analysis. So the way you move through an airport, does it look like you're somebody that I'm not necessarily trying to find out your identity, but I might be trying to assess, are you looking suspicious in some way? Are you somebody that perhaps should be pulled over?
Try to find the shortest queue to get coffee. You know?
Yeah, I mean, exactly. Are you looking like a tired parent trying to navigate an airport? So there's lots of different applications. As you can imagine, it's very personal technology, because it's technology that's doing something with your face. As you know, this isn't something that you can change. This isn't something you can hide.
But
so the government having that capability is something that you really need to think carefully about. And we deliberated with the public, and they took all of this evidence. And they did feel that there were some use cases where actually, I mean, they didn't use the word proportionality, but they essentially were saying, look, if this is a really serious crime, if this is a really great social need, this feels like it might be a legitimate use. But we want it to have really proper guardrails around it. Firstly, we want to make sure that it works technically at what it's doing. Does this work as well for all different sorts of faces? Is this going to have, as we know from some biometric technology, is this going to have some kind of discrimination perhaps against certain groups that aren't as well represented in the training information? Or is it going to be used in a way that might be discriminatory? Is it going to be only used in certain neighbourhoods among certain groups? So how do we make sure that kind of it's doing what it ought to do? And then also, do we have the right legal guardrails around it so this doesn't become a kind of low-cost application? This doesn't become something that is normalised across society because it is very intrusive. So this is a really interesting finding that has come out of all the kind of in-depth public deliberation, kind of citizen jury type things we've done. The public are really worried about the use of technology that might create a kind of two-tier society or might exacerbate a kind of social set of inequalities. So if you're using technology to kind of group people or separate people or put certain groups at higher risk, that was felt to just not really be socially acceptable. That was felt to be just because it's technically possible. That's not the way these technologies should be used. So the public are really, you know, that concern showed up in biometrics, but it also showed up in other sorts of applications like COVID. If you throw your mind back, COVID vaccine passports, people were really worried about the idea that outside of an emergency situation, it might be normalized that you could separate groups based on their health status. That felt really uncomfortable. That's not something we should introduce or do lightly in society. So for some of these technologies, the technological capacity is there, but really these are about social and political questions. You know, what sort of society do we want to build? How do we want technologies integrated as they get more powerful? How do we also want them kind of curtailed or restrained in the same way as we do other forms of kind of technological innovation?
But I come back to it. I mean, I get this right, and the public sector could become a kind of gold standard. So we want, you know, our banks, our supermarkets, our cinema chains to operate by the same criteria. Am I dreaming, or is that a possibility?
I mean,
am dreaming.
No, that's not what I was saying. I think it's interesting because often what you hear is actually the inverse of that argument. So quite often what I hear amongst the public sector is, look, people are so used to being able to do stuff on their phones, on apps. We need to really pull our socks up and we need to try and mimic what the private sector are doing in some of these kind of technological innovations. So often the thing I hear is actually the other way around. But I agree, if the public sector get it, design choices around technology right, then there might be opportunity for them to kind of set a high bar. I think the anxiety amongst public servants and public sector and civil society is that, you know, traditionally the public sector is seen as slow and not very innovative, not very good at procuring IT, getting trapped in legacy systems. Everyone's had bad experiences about trying to manage new bits of kind of technology being built into services that don't do what they're supposed to.
Yep.
And end up causing headaches and you get bounced around and the kind of computer says no anxiety. If anything, I think the anxiety I hear from the public sector working on this is almost the other way around. How can we really galvanise the public sector to say, yes, these technologies are new. Yes, they, you know, they're evolving, but we do need to kind of figure out how we could use them for the public good. We shouldn't kind of fear them.
This season of the We Society is brought to you in association with the Nuffield Foundation. For more than 80 years, the Nuffield Foundation has funded research and innovations that sit at the heart of some of society's biggest challenges. Evidence has the power to change lives, whether it's improving educational outcomes, reducing inequality, or understanding how society is changing. The Nuffield Foundation's work helps policymakers and practitioners tackle complex problems. To find out more about the Foundation and its research centres, visit nuffieldfoundation.org.
I'm one of the people who think this. A merchant bank, an investment bank in the city, came out with this too, that Britain is on the cusp of becoming Europe's Silicon Valley, and that we've got a lot of tech capacities, a lot of startups, a lot of scale-ups in this space, including artificial intelligence. And actually what's required is smarter public procurement and private procurement of these technologies in order to help these fledgling companies really grow into great companies of tomorrow and actually get it right. We could be the top dog in Europe. So public procurement becomes essentially ingredient in this story.
Yeah, no, procurement. We've actually, my colleagues Mavis Maturi and Anna Studman did a two-year study looking at procurement of AI across different local authorities. So both doing a documentary analysis, but also talking to people, like, how does this work on the ground? Like, do you guys really know how to assess these technologies?
Are American companies too dominant in this space?
The American tech companies are so dominant in terms of, well, really in every aspect of the stack, in terms of the research, in terms of setting the narrative, in terms of really in the era of AI, you have a very small number of actors who have these kind of foundation models, who have these kind of general purpose tools. And a lot of the AI we're talking about, even if it's a tool that, you know, a bit of the government have built, what it's resting on are those foundation models that exist in Silicon Valley. So we've got a very small number of actors who are exceptionally powerful, exceptionally rich, you know, and have a lot, an absolutely huge role in kind of shaping the terms of debate. And I think that's why questions of sovereignty are so high up the agenda at the moment, and why a lot of countries are suddenly asking questions around sovereignty and AI. There's this thing of, how do we not entirely become dependent on a small number of actors in Silicon Valley?
And the answer is?
Well, it's not an easy answer to manage. I mean, it's something that we're looking at. It's something that we're working on, but I don't have an immediate answer to that, apart from saying what we do need to do, I think, is bring a lot more critical analysis around the power and dependencies that we are building into a very small number of companies. So when we're talking about rapidly rolling out AI across the public sector, what we're also talking about is building in dependencies about the way we run the public sector on a small number of actors in Silicon Valley. So we've really got to think hard, and I think we've really got to scrutinize the kind of relationships we've got with those. We've seen examples where you've got big technology companies coming in and working for free or training people up in their own tools or, you know, getting in to help build a data system for only kind of a very small amount of money. And of course, then when they're fully integrated, we don't really understand what the ongoing costs will be.
Criticisms about how, you know, the Ministry of Defence has been giving contracts out to a number of American contractors in such a way that it's almost impossible when the contract comes to an end not to renew it, and then to renew it and make it bigger than the contract that's just expired. And so you become completely dependent upon, you know, American capacities. We don't have our own American capacities here in the UK.
And we also don't have the sort of regulatory environment that forces these things to be interoperable. So once you are in one package system, it might be that you're very much trapped in that legacy system for all sorts of other bits that you want to build off it. What we don't have is the kind of market regulation that means that it's very easy to just say, that's fine, I'll just pull my data out of that and I'll go over here, I'll migrate over here. So I think questions of dependency, questions of vendor lock-in, future costs need to always be front of mind when we're talking about accelerating AI in public sector, because some of what we're talking about are those things. We're not just talking about this as if it's a kind of free-flowing resource we can kind of pull from the air. Some of this stuff is very much dependent on a very small number of players, every level of the stack or every level of the kind of value chain of what we're talking about.
And this is what you tell the Public Accounts Committee?
Yes. I think one of the things that we're certainly calling for is much more scrutiny around the relationship between some of those big technology companies, much more kind of scrutiny put on assumptions about costs and future costs and value for money and productivity figures. A lot of this stuff, it's quite hard to predict future costs. It's quite hard to predict legacy lock-in costs. And I guess there's another potential that perhaps we ought to mention, which is there is a, you know, increasing expectation that what we have at the moment is an AI bubble, and at some point that will burst.
Perish the thought.
But that's going to have a huge ripple effect across the sorts of bets that we're making and the things that we're building in at the moment. So, but as ever, it's very difficult working in this space, because you're trying to both talk about specific tools and how they could be used, but you also have to think about this in terms of the players and the power that is very much entangled up with adopting AI or collecting more data. These things, you can't necessarily separate them very easily.
We talked about kind of rewiring the public sector at the very beginning. You know, help us imagine what that might amount to in 5 or 10 years' time. Because to the extent it's exciting is the extent to which it's not a bubble.
It's sort of difficult for me to navigate that question because it's quite hard to separate out all the hype
right.
from the evidence.
Right.
So I suppose there are a lot of people that are painting a very rosy picture of the potential, and there's some of the things you might hear are that all we need to do is really unleash AI. We really need to let it go. We really need to open up all our data, and then we can do things like cure cancer, and then we can eradicate all waiting lists, and we can have this kind of utopia of the state. The work we do at ADA is just trying to bring that much closer to the ground and say, how can we apply the same sort of evidence standards when it comes to technology? How do we just treat this as a normal thing? How do we evaluate it the same way we would any major bit of public investment or any major decision about changes to the way that you run a service? Firstly, let's start with, what are the right priority questions that we need to ask? Like, what's the social need here? Let's not start with the technology and the opportunity. Let's start with some particular priorities that the state needs to fund, needs to solve even. And then let's think, what do we know about what works in terms of solving that problem? And can technology play a role in that? And if so, what technology and how might we evaluate it? And what do we need around that to actually make the whole service be able to make the most of that technology? And we know from our work with the public, there's a lot more that needs to go around the technology to make it trusted. And actually, one of the biggest barriers to rewiring the state for the government and public services and public sector to, I suppose, make the most of data and AI is public trust. We really need the public to think that what the government is doing when it comes to collecting information about its citizens and its residents, when it comes to making profoundly important questions, you know, the state is responsible for decisions about removing a child from their parents. The state is responsible for decisions about whether or not you can access a life-changing drug for a particular illness. The state is responsible about decisions about whether you can be incarcerated. You've got this very, very high set of questions. So it's so vitally important that where technology is used, it's seen as, it's trusted, it's trustworthy, it's seen as legitimate by the people who are subject to it.
What you just said is quite concerning. I mean, because folk like you and me say this in the public square, I kind of hope that actually the people writing the algorithms are aware of the dangers. You work in this, you know, hour by hour, week by week. I mean, how concerned should we be?
I think it's a mixed picture. So on the one hand, I think compared to just a few years ago, we've got much more transparency about where these sorts of tools are being used. The government piloted something called the Algorithmic Transparency Reporting Standard. In theory, all algorithms that have a significant effect on the public should be there. I don't think they are, but there's a much bigger collection, at least, that we can look at than we had even a few years ago. We've got loads more evaluation going on. We've got the absolute, I would say, kind of world-leading safety institute that's doing brilliant research about kind of safety concerns of these. So I think there's definitely some kind of positive things going on. I think on the flip side, we've had a step back from the kind of regulatory commitments that we think we need for this. There's been a move away from regulation rather than towards regulation.
That's driven by the industry, I think, to a degree, isn't it?
And geopolitics. We've had a move away from, you know, a few years ago, all the big tech companies talked a lot about ethics and responsibility and accountability, and they had teams in-house to do this stuff. A lot of that has been cut away.
What's your kind of private hope you're now going to make public about that you'll be proudest of in your research? Where have you made the biggest impact?
I think one of the ways we've made a big impact is really by amplifying the voices of the public. There's a lot of people who have opinions about AI, but fundamentally these data-driven technologies are having a profound effect on the way we live, on our relationship with key services, on our relationship with the state, on how we access information, on where our children spend their time. And so to be able to conduct research with publics to amplify their views and play that back into policy debates feels really important. I mean, to end on an upbeat note, you said earlier, is there potential that the UK government, you know, could be really leading with some of this stuff? Could we set out this kind of great positive vision? I think there is the potential for some of that to happen, because actually we know we kind of keep hearing consistently the same things that need to happen. We need regulation. We need evaluation. We need greater transparency. We need a really clear story to tell to the public about why we are doing certain things with their data, about why we're using tools in certain ways, and being really honest with them about whether it's experimental, and if so, what the safeguards are, about what some of the opportunities are, but also what the risks are and how they're being mitigated. I think there's real opportunity if we do those things, if we kind of move into a more evidence-driven space, we have a more mature conversation with the public. I think there is a real opportunity that the UK could get this right. I think that takes political leadership to do that. And I think it means that we slightly need to resist the big hype narratives out there and just bring some of these debates back down to earth.
Imogen Parker, thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences in association with the Leverhulme Trust and the Nuffield Foundation. I'm Will Hutton. The producer is Emily Finch, and it's a Whistledown production. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast, leave a comment, share with your colleagues and friends. And thank you so much for listening.